The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist. Today we're going to be dealing with a series of topics concerning Ukraine, which has been a great area of interest for us. Largely because of their position as a relatively small state in a very difficult neighborhood, but also as an Orthodox state. And I want to make it clear that a true and serious, intellectually respectable Ukrainian nationalist position is not anti-Russian. That has never been the case. While it's true that in the diaspora, in America, in Canada, you have a strong anti-Russian sense, but that's not necessarily how it needs to be. Russia is a brother of Ukraine in terms of its religion, its stress on agrarianism, its love of the ancient tradition. The unfortunate thing is that the Russian monarchy, particularly from Peter, if not Catherine, onward has been very ham-handed. It's been very poor policy. I want to say, first of all, that in dealing with Ukrainian history, the main issue is that Russia and the Russians have always viewed Kiev as the mother of all Russian cities. It is the womb from which the Russian Orthodox vision emerged. It's also the case that throughout Ukrainian history, a strong, very large pro-Russian group has always existed, and this has been based also on religious affinity. The Ukrainian nationalist merely says that Russia has no right to dominate Ukraine politically or economically. On the other hand, it is legitimate to say that the Ukrainians should be in a brotherly relationship with the Russians, that is to say, a relationship of equals. Two different cultures, similar cultures, sharing the fruits of their labor. And that's something that's, I think, is part of a legitimate, rather than the xenophobic and anti-Russian Ukrainian nationalist point of view. The cardinal error of the Ukrainian nationalist movement in the 20th century has been that siding with the West has not been an effective way of dealing with Russia. It is true that Russia and then the Soviet Union, which was only partially Russian, dealt with Ukraine in a very poor way. Ukraine was exploited, and it was exploited in a colonial fashion. At the same time, I could recognize, and I think any serious Ukrainian nationalist and traditionalist can recognize, that Russia realized that Ukraine could be a staging ground for anti-Russian hostile powers. And from the Russian point of view in the 19th century, you're talking about Austria and Germany using Ukraine as a way of getting to Russia. And rather, you know, than being opposed to Germany, it seems that the Prussian monarchy and Russia had far more in common than they did in terms of opposition. And as a result, World War I was a great tragedy, because the fact is that Germany and Russia were connected in terms of its political system, in terms of the family relations between the royal powers, you know, as well as the general outlook on life that both countries shared. And of course, they shared a border, and they both equally opposed any kind of Polish nationalism, which at least historically has always been an oligarchic and a corrupt form of nationalism. It has not been nationalism as such. It has been either a clerical or an oligarchic system of rule. So I want to get that out of the way. I want to get this concept that a Ukrainian nationalist has to be anti-Russian. There is no connection between the relations, let's say, between Ukraine and Russia as you had between Ireland and England. I mean, England actually maintained a genocidal policy against the Irish. There could be no doubt about this in terms of starvation tactics. This is normal. That was never the case in terms of Ukraine. Now, you saw that in the Soviet Union. But I'm going to deny that the Soviet Union was primarily Russian. The Soviet Union was a Jewish internationalist cabal. It's had nothing to do, in fact, with Russian nationalism whatsoever. Russian nationalism and the Russian people were violently assaulted under the Soviet system, and I'll tell you right now that as the Russian Orthodox Church was burned to the ground under the USSR, not a single synagogue was ever touched, showing really that there is an ethnic basis to the USSR, and it certainly was not Russian. However, it does need to be said that this is not necessarily an apologia for the later Romanovs. I have defended the later Romanovs with some vehemence. As of late, I'm not doing that. I've backed off from that position, really for a whole bunch of reasons. A lot of them are religious, but a lot of them had to do with Ukraine. Instead of fostering a brotherly people, instead of fostering friends, within the Orthodox faith, the Russian monarchs did everything in their power to oppress the Ukrainian population, to empower those who supported the Russian Imperium by granting them lands and granting them all kinds of privileges in exchange for loyalty, which of course created the Ukrainian nationalist movement. So let that serve as my introduction today. I'm a Ukrainian nationalist and an Orthodox person within that tradition, but I am not anti-Russian. Whatever anti-Russianism I have exists solely as an attack on the Synod of Peter the Great, which suppressed the Orthodox Church, bringing it under royal control. The complete loss of faith that you find within the St. Petersburg circles and elite circles that were deeply into the occult. Unfortunately, you can't deny that anymore. But that's not, you know, Solzhenitsyn's position was always that Ukrainians should live on Ukrainian territory and Russians should live on Russian territory. And that's something that I subscribe to. And any serious nationalist position is going to say that an ethnic people should remain on their ethnic land. That will not eliminate all conflicts, but at least will give us a kind of a framework to resolve conflicts as they grow. Nevertheless, the Russian nation, the Russian people, and the Russian Orthodox Church has been nothing but a friend to the Orthodox world and to the Ukrainian people. Unfortunately, it's that church being attached to the Petrine and then Katharinian state that has allowed it to be an oppressive force. And that's really the problem. It is not the church, it is not the people, it is not its institutions. And I'm also going to say it's not the monarchy. It is the bureaucracy. I want to make something very clear here before I continue. There is a very large distinction in St. Petersburg between the Russian Imperium, the Russian monarch, and the church on the one hand, and the Petersburg bureaucracy on the other. I want to make that very clear. The bureaucracy was a class of its own. It had a life of its own. It had interests of its own, more or less opposed to the interests of the monarchy. And so in terms of dealing with either domestic or foreign policy, whether it be in terms of serfdom or a peasant indebtedness or the oppression of the old believers, oppression of the Ukrainians, whatever it might be, I'm quite willing to say that the bureaucracy and that class that was attached to it and that it comprised it was far more to blame than the actual monarch himself, whose actual opinions on the matter may have been very, very different. And that's another, problem. Now, the political theory of people like Kostomarov and even Drahomanov in Ukraine suggested something that also needs to be addressed today. And that is the concept that Ukrainians are individualists, that they are yeoman farmers, while Russians have a tendency to be communal, apolitical, and subject to authority with far more readiness than Ukrainians. Now, that is true as far as it goes, but how far does it go? I want to make something clear, and I think I said this the last time. It needs to be said again, though, that the mentality of Kostomarov in terms of these two peoples, two political peoples living very different lives, they've created two very different political systems. That's true. But we also have to remember that it doesn't go very far. What Kostomarov and Drahomanov, really the former more than anybody else, what they're really referring to is Central Russia. This radius of maybe 300 miles around the city of Moscow, the ancient heartland of Ivan Kalita, these people and the early monarchs of Moscow. I want to say that heavily forested, very poor soil did lend itself to communal farming and the necessary development of a centralized monarchy. That's true. However, we need to keep in mind that in places like Novgorod and Pskov, as well as northern Russia, Siberia, the southern parts of Russia, that is not the case. You did have a yeoman farmer. You did have a very free, albeit communal, form of land tenure and land holding. So what people like Kostomarov are saying is that Russia is reducible to that central Russian Muscovite zone, and would not include Novgorod or Pskov or any of these other places. You'll see in the Russian north, although the soil is very, very poor, trade becomes extremely important. The fact is that you have a freedom-loving, very hardy kind of Russian yeoman peasant. And so that needs to be taken care of right away. So that's really this issue between Russia and Ukraine. And we need to remember that in the 19th century, it is very difficult for Russians or anyone else to have this idea that Ukraine could ever really be independent. That's not an attack on Ukrainians, right? I mean, you see, in as far as Ireland is concerned, it would be relatively easy for the Irish to be independent, albeit economically dependent on Great Britain in terms of trade and liquidity and everything else that you need. People like Eamon de Valera tried to eliminate that connection. But here's a place where Ireland and Ukraine really don't match up. And that refers to the idea that Ukraine was surrounded by enemies, that Ukraine at any given moment was in the crosshairs of the Germans, of the Polish landlords, of the Austrian Empire, or in earlier years, the Polish Empire, and in some cases, even the Turkish Empire, and of course, Russia herself. So this notion of Russian oppression of Ukraine is problematic, if only to the extent that what we're really dealing with is Russia attempting to shield Ukraine from being a part of the orbit of some other country, and thereby keeping Ukraine and integrating her within the Russian orbit with the idea of taking advantage of her soil, of her tremendous, by comparison, her tremendous literacy and scientific knowledge, as well as her tremendous piety. Something that Ukrainians have been known for a long time. So, again, some Ukrainians might get upset with me on that, but it is the case. Russian policy in Ukraine was very poorly thought out. Nevertheless, the mentality behind that policy really had more to do with keeping Ukraine out of the hands of opposing parties than having some, bizarre desire to oppress the Ukrainians. However, I will affirm, continue to affirm, that Ukrainians are a separate people from Russians. They have a separate language, and they have a separate approach to life that, morally speaking, from a consistent nationalist point of view, morally speaking, demands that Ukraine not only be independent politically and economically, but also have her own church. I want to make a comment now on the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church, and I want to say that in the sense that I am a priest that comes from the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church, in the sense that my bishop, Archbishop John of New Jersey, comes from that very same organization, that the Milan Synod itself connected itself to Patriarch Volodymyr of Kiev and all Ukraine in the 90s, and that most of our bishops really do derive in one way or another from the older Ukrainian autocephalous movement in America and Canada. I want to say that, unfortunately, the Ukrainian church at one time had great promise. Unfortunately, it no longer does. I'm going to make a couple of comments here. That in the Orthodox world, the idea of ecumenism is a heresy. The idea of ecumenism suggests that the Orthodox Church is not the true Church of Jesus Christ, and therefore needs to join with others in order to gain the fullness of that experience. And we reject that as a heresy, and we hold dogmatically that the Orthodox Church is the Church of Christ and is the only Church of Christ, outside of which there is no grace and no salvation. Now, I could quote many church fathers who say that, but ecumenism denies that. And in denying that, they fall into heresy. And not only do they fall into heresy, it's also a sin against the Holy Spirit, because it denies that there's a connection between the action of the Holy Spirit on the one hand and truth, theological truth, on the other hand. The problem as far as Ukraine is concerned, particularly in recent years, is that in their desire to be recognized, as if recognition is some sort of theological category, to be recognized by the Patriarch of Constantinople or the Patriarch of Romania or whatever, they have engaged in substantial ecumenical relations. That's the case of the so-called Ukrainian Patriarchate under Filaret, the breakaway UAOC under Mefodiev, as well as, you know, these splinter groups like the UAOC America and all of these other groups, all of which are involved in ecumenical activities. And therefore, a true Orthodox man could have nothing to do with them. The largest body is the Patriarch of Kiev, which was created by by Mstislav and Vladimir, who come from the Orthodox Church of Poland. And so, canonically speaking, there's no doubt as to their validity. There is doubt, however, as to the validity of Filaret, the current Patriarch of Kiev. Here's the problem. Filaret was a KGB agent, and he admitted as much, in the Russian Orthodox Church, who spent his career, in fact was assigned by the KGB to assault the idea of Ukrainian nationalism and the idea of a Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church. When Patriarch Alexei, who passed away recently, of Moscow was elected, it was Filaret who lost that election by one vote. And as a result of that, he left the Russian Orthodox Church and suddenly, immediately, proclaimed himself to be a Ukrainian Orthodox partisan. He became a bishop in the UAOC under Filaret. He was eventually anathematized under Mstislav, and was ultimately anathematized by Mstislav. But when communism fell in Ukraine, Mstislav moved back to Ukraine, became Patriarch of all Ukraine in 1991. He died in 93. Filaret began to gather all of the assets, cars and everything else that the Ukrainian Autocephalous Church possessed. And he began to dominate the synod. Mstislav died in 93, and Vladimir who the Milan Synod partially derives from, was elected patriarch, and he reigned from 93 to 95. And he passed away amid scenes of violence in Kiev. Now, Mstislav and Vladimir were opposed to ecumenical relations, and they were opposed to relations with the Moscow Patriarchate that they properly said, number one, was an agent of oppression of Ukraine, and number two, was the creation of the KGB. And they're, in fact, correct on both counts. The problem is that under Volodymyr, who in my mind is a saint, Volodymyr lived in the Gulag camps for some time, for many years, until he was permitted to emigrate to America, where he became a priest and then a bishop in the United States and Canada. Filaret, his last name is Isnienko, began to essentially use his great wealth and KGB connections to buy up the assets of the Ukrainian church. Volodymyr died in 94-95, well, probably was poisoned, and Filaret took over, but not before a group of patriots in Ukraine had separated and created, under a guy by the name of Patriarch Dmitry, created the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church separate from Kiev. Both groups continue to exist. Filaret is now Patriarch of Kiev, although we do not accept his office. We accept the office, we don't accept him as a legitimate patriarch. He essentially bought his way into that. He is a married man with children. Of course, Orthodox bishops and monks cannot be married, although our priests can be married. As well as being a radical ecumenist who now gives communion to the Uniates and the Greek Catholics, as well as to anyone who will ask him. And as a result, he is not an Orthodox bishop and is certainly not Patriarch of Ukraine. But, you know, the fall of the UAOC in Ukraine includes the fact that the current head of the UAOC, Metropolitan Mefodia, is also an ecumenist and, as such, is a heretic, you know, from the Orthodox point of view. So what we have is the complete fall, dissolution, and auto-demolition of the entire Ukrainian autocephalist movement in and out of the country, making matters more obnoxious. The bulk of Ukrainian parishes in Western Europe and America and Canada have gone under the ecumenical patriarchate, the Patriarch of Constantinople, which is ecumenist as well as being Masonic. The Patriarch of Constantinople is largely funded by Rothschild money, and funded to a great extent as a result of that by the British government, which goes back to British policies in the Balkans from the 19th century. So the Ukrainian Orthodox situation is a mess. It is a disaster. And I'm here to say that the Milan Synod, who came under the Patriarchate of Vladimir in 93 and 94, is really the only remaining part of the Ukrainian autocephalous movement that still stands and that is non-ecumenically minded and is not a part of the World Council of Churches or any other Rockefeller organization in the world. And that's a substantial problem in the Ukrainian world, and it's a betrayal of the legitimate aspirations of the Ukrainian Orthodox people to maintain their culture and traditions independently, which is what autocephalous means, self-ruled, self-controlled. So I know that that can, you know, there's so many jurisdictions and bishops and these people who claim to be what they're not. It's very convoluted, but that's the nature of the Ukrainian situation today. And those in the Ukrainian Autocephalous Church have largely fallen into heresy and schism because of everything that we have discussed here, and as a result are not Ukrainian churches and are not Orthodox churches. And quite frankly, Patriarch Filaret, so-called, largely views the church as a means to his own ends, his own political ends, and his own financial ends. And the man is a multimillionaire. Of course, monks cannot possess any property. But unfortunately, that's the case all over the place these days, where some of these bishops have become very, very wealthy and really use the church as a cash cow for themselves, and in Filaret's case, as a way of promoting his political ideas. And Filaret not only has been KGB in the past, but now has cooperated with the CIA in the installation of Viktor Yushchenko as president of Ukraine, and maintains his ties with the American CIA as well as the Vatican as a way of solidifying his power. So that's very embarrassing, but unfortunately that's how it is. And that is the first half of our show for the day. We'll be back in a little while, and we're going to talk about something else. Okay, hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Medievalist. I spent the first half of the show really dealing with kind of peripheral issues that have come up that I kind of needed to get out of the way in terms of the Ukrainian Orthodox world and the idea of a Ukrainian nationalist church. And I want to make clear to my listeners that nationalism and the Orthodox doctrinal tradition are not in opposition. When you say that there is a national church body in Ukraine or Serbia or Greece, all you're saying is that the single universal canonical tradition of the Orthodox world is enculturated into a specific area. In the Ukrainian case, the universal canonical tradition of the church is enculturated within the Ukrainian point of view. Ukrainian traditions, Ukrainian saints, the Cossack movement, the Ukrainian language, Ukrainian and agrarianism and social ideals, and her history. None of that alters the universal canonical tradition of the church. It's just that it gives it a cultural background within which to work. So an Orthodox nationalist point of view is perfectly Orthodox. It simply says that there is one canonical tradition manifest in different traditions, linguistic groups, and historical groups, whether it be from Bulgaria or Greece or the Middle East or Ukraine or Russia. So I want to make it clear that it is one Orthodox church manifest identically within differing historical and cultural circumstances, defined by language, ethnicity, and tradition. That's how the Orthodox Church has been traditionally organized, and as a result, the Orthodox liturgy is done in Bulgarian, in Bulgaria, in Greek, in Greece, in English, in America, in Ukrainian, in Ukraine. And it's something that's always been a point of pride in the Orthodox world, is that in our ethnic organization, we can reach the common population in his own language, within his own tradition, within his own cultural context. But speaking of which, I want to talk about something. I read an article not too long ago on a topic that, quite frankly, needs to be talked about. He's talking about one of my favorite poets, Ivan Franko. Ivan Franko is a social nationalist, poet, and essayist in the late 19th, early 20th century Ukraine. He is one of the most popular poets in Ukraine, and to a great extent manifests the good things both in nationalism as well as in socialism. And he has a vision of literary creativity, you know, poetry, film, writing, even political activism. And I want to talk about that today. And Ivan Franko really kind of fits into everything we've been talking about. He is an absolutely central figure, not just in Ukrainian life, but in the mentality of social nationalism. Franko was not particularly a Christian man. I think he respected the church to the extent that it was Ukrainian and national, but was probably not a believer himself. But his vision of literary creativity should be taken seriously. The first point is that Franko holds that anything that the poet does, that the writer does, has to derive from the folk culture of the people. It cannot exist apart from that. So for a Ukrainian, it has to be, the poetic mind has to synthesize the ideas and the experiences and the mentality of the Ukrainian farmer under foreign occupation, under oppression. That the nation and the people are the center of all the work that you do. But this is something very common in the Ukrainian mind, that the national collective is central. If you're a poet or a writer or a TV producer or a banker, nothing that you do will have any moral value unless it derives from the life of the people. But the life of the people is inconceivable without a cultural matrix. And that cultural matrix for the Ukrainian world is the agrarian life, the Orthodox life, the life of the extended family, and the individualist tradition of at least Western and Central Ukraine. That's something of immense importance. And when I say individualist, I'm not talking about that in the Western sense. I'm just talking about a way of economic organization that stressed the family over the commune that you would find in Russia. There was communal land holding in Ukraine, but it was far looser than it was in Russia. So we're talking about the family as opposed to the Russian commune. Both are equally valuable, but it really depends on the nature of economic and and the circumstances of the climate, really, in dealing with the two countries. But literature, you know, Franco defines literature as something very broad. It's any artifact that the people create. So it would include painting and writing and politics, so long as it's actually a popular politics, and economics and farming and everything else. All of this can be treated in literary form. In fact, all of this is literary in it, the very fact of its production and its maintenance. Because while we have, you know, very obvious economic needs that need to be maintained, different nations will fulfill these needs in very different ways. That any poet, any real person who is trying to reach the common folk, that these people need to be aware of the traditions, of the opinions, of the religion of the common people that they're trying to reach. The poet cannot be a stranger of society. The poet has to be within society, has to be saturated with that society. There is no objectivity. There is no such thing. There is no place to stand outside of the cultural milieu of the people who you identify with. There is no such thing. This is the problem of sociology. Sociology has to be connected. Political theory has to be connected to a specific living group of people with their own historical memory and music and literature and everything that makes them distinct. For Ivan Franko, the poetry is manifesting. And here's a religious idea that comes up in Franco's work, that it manifests the reality of the divine embedded and imminent in the day-to-day life of the common people. This is a huge and profound point. I want to make it clear that the Ukrainian Orthodox vision does not view God as this entity that lives up in the sky somewhere, floating around like the sun. That's false theology. That's baby theology. What we're really talking about here is the Logos, or the word or the connection, the metaphysical, the connection, the energy that holds the created world together. This is the manifestation of Christ in nature. He is the author of natural law. In talking about scientific regularity, we are talking about the manifestation of the Logos of Jesus Christ in created things. He is not created things, but he is manifest in created things. But that's what poetry does. That's what nationalism is. It sees the hand of God in the day-to-day creations of the common folk, because the nation shows the people, the folk, constantly connected in every way. This eliminates classes and hierarchy. We're talking about Ukrainians as Ukrainians, Irishmen as Irishmen. We're not talking about classes. And I know on this program I talked about the notion of estates in medieval political thought. And that's perfectly legitimate within a national idea, but it has to understand that these estates have no power over anybody else. That these functions in society, embedded within a certain national ideal, these don't have power over anybody else outside of their particular area of expertise. And that's really where nationalism differs from the older medieval point of view. We're not necessarily talking about hierarchy. We're talking about a functionally based equality, or a complex equality. But the idea of poetry is to see the nature of these connections, how God and the energies of God manifest in natural law, and the connection within all things. I call them ecosystems today, but the connection between all things and among all of things, this is God's presence. And it cannot be explained or understood in any other way. Science might talk about their external connection, and that's perfectly legitimate. But their internal energy is something else. And where this internal energy comes from is another matter altogether. Poetry is all about these connections. But these connections never exist in isolation. These connections exist as a part of the ethnic, historical people, the folk. Poetry, according to Franco, is prayer. It's one and the same thing. It takes, you know, from what we've been talking about, it takes the person from their mundane day-to-day life and expresses within these connections the higher life, the basis of all of these connections. It lifts you up from the world of power, the world of cause and effect. It bridges time and space. It must. Any national or ethnic group has to bridge time and space, because the very fact that you are a part of an ethnic group or that you identify with an ethnic group means that you are in immediate connection and communion with people from generations ago that helped create the mentality and the ideas of the ethnic connection. The people who suffered to create independence, the people who suffered to maintain the people as they suffered under foreign occupation or economic exploitation or whatever. So in the process of all of this, this idea of poetry as prayer, poetry then is a method of mobilization and, as a result, liberation. And remember, we talk about poetry and literature, we're talking about something substantial, far more than just words on a page. We're talking about the manifestation of how people live their lives. We're talking about the agrarian world, the closeness with nature and natural forms, all of this within the ethnic identity that humanizes all of these connections. But in terms of literature, we're talking about everything: politics and economics, economic organization, essays, journalism, poetry itself. Any artifact that comes from the folk it can be classed as something poetic, something literary. And it's a pretty radical point of view, particularly in the late 19th century. It was a fairly radical view. It was a romantic view that there's a connection between the people and the land, and that was mediated by the idea of the Logos and the ethnic connections among and within peoples. For Franco, he was a socialist. He did believe in the basic economic equality of peoples. But he also rejected the idea of socialism as a centralized political movement. Socialism becomes a great evil when it's centralized. And this is something, we'll deal with this some other time, but even during the Soviet era, Ukrainian political activists like Hunchar and Shelest and these other people, they wanted to see a USSR decentralized, nationalized into its component peoples and religions and communities, which of course was rejected by Moscow. But the Ukrainian idea is that socialism is to be national, is to be agrarian, is to be decentralized. It's never to be a means of controlling people. It's a way of empowering people, of empowering the ethnos, of empowering the commune, the extended family, the farming family, to take their own economic production and their own world into their own hands. That's really the concept of Ukrainian socialism, and you see it in Ireland as well, to a great extent. And so you have people like Franco saying that the Russian Bolshevik movement and the social democratic movement is the greatest evil of all time. So you have a real social nationalist like Franco saying that the Russian Bolsheviks and the Russian social democrats and the Russian revolutionaries are the greatest evil, because they're going to now show us the worst of all worlds. They're going to attempt to impose some kind of equality solely from a single center, Moscow. So now you have party control, you have bureaucratic control, and worst of all of this control is done in a ethnic vacuum. Nobody exists but the bureaucracy. So what really happens is that when all said and done, the idea of Ivan Franko's concept of literary creativity is ultimately that the individual, the family, the farmstead, this is the atom of the Ukrainian national organism. This is that which needs to be empowered to be able to fight back in one way or another against the global economy. And as we talked about in previous shows here, we've dealt with these questions of Ukrainian economic mismanagement and the oppression of the population. Inflation, the rule of the bankers, the rule of these capitalist vultures and vampires who live not by production, not through productive enterprise, but by manipulating the labor of others. So for people like Ivan Franko, ultimately the ideal political organization is national anarchism, is the idea of national communitarianism and national populism. This is the essence of the social nationalist ideal. We're rejecting centralization. We're empowering communities and local farmers to be able to fight back against the global economic order. And that's what nationalism is all about. And that's what Franco is talking about. And this is the ideal, not merely of Ukraine, but of all ethnic nationalist thinking, is the empowerment of the folk, the empowerment of local communities and farmsteads. Not the manipulation of their produce, not the creation of artificial needs and everything that comes out of the modern Western point of view. And now Ukrainian television, which is controlled almost exclusively by Jews in Ukraine now, and oligarchs, is saturated, absolutely saturated with commercials and Western pornography and Western entertainments and everything else. Warner Brothers has almost totally taken over their television. And that's what's going on right now. And so we're talking about a revolutionary approach. We're talking about the understanding of what God is and where he can be found within the Orthodox idea. He is immanent in his creation. He is not that creation, but his energy and his power is to be manifest and is manifest in that creation. And from that comes natural law. And understanding that in its ethnic and religious context is central to understanding what a people is and what makes a people distinct and significant. That's Ivan Franko's view, and to a great extent, that's also my view. And I want to thank everyone for listening. I appreciate everyone at the Voice of Reason Network, Steve and Mike and Dietrich and everybody else. I want to thank you for everything. I want to thank you for supporting this show and asking me to do this show, and I appreciate everything you do for me. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Ariane.